control and responsibility. What exactly does this mean? Well, you know, being the second speaker in a forum like this, you feel some obligation to, you know, to provide some counterpoint to the first speaker. So, alternative title of my talk, I was, you know, one thing to give the ASA people when they first organized this is why Jack is brown. Well, unfortunately, Jack's treatment of this topic, if you've read his book, is just so comprehensive and just so overwhelmingly complete that there's nothing more that I can say about this. And you know, I have to spend the rest of my time telling you why Jack is right. And in particular, I'm going to be spending my time this morning with you talking, really unpacking just one aspect or a couple of aspects of what Jack has said this morning. So, let me tell you something a little bit about myself. I think you could say quite safely that I am a technologist of sorts. I run a research program in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and we have a significant group with funding from several agencies. And, you know, we do all kinds of stuff, ranging from networking to sensors to target tracking, even some bio kind of stuff. And so you could say that one of the things I do as a technologist is to develop technology, but I'm also a user of technology myself. I'm sort of ashamed to say that every morning when I wake up, the first thing I do is to walk up to my computer and turn it on. And before I do anything else, because, you know, it takes some time to boot up, you know, it's a pain, really. But that's why I have to do that. And then I say good morning to my wife, who's, you know, and then my kids. Well, thinking Christianly about technology, when I first started my life in my academic career as a Christian, we started talking about integrating faith without discipline. And when I bring up this topic among technologists, you know, you always get this sort of puzzled look. You know, what's the big deal? What's there to think about in technology that is so Christian, or that, you know, what does Christianity have to do with it? And people ask questions like, you know, I mean, what am I supposed to do when I design my chip? You know, how would Jesus design his chip? You know, what exactly are we supposed to be doing here? Now, we've seen commentary from Jack's work that tells us that there's so much to talk about Christianly in technology. And so I just want to illustrate this by showing you a little animation that was done by a student in my lab. He's an Air Force ROTC student. He was a senior design student in my lab, and he wanted to render some of the data we had in doing target tracking with unmanned aerial vehicles. And, you know, that's all we do in our lab, target tracking. But he wants to illustrate why one does this sort of target tracking. This slide I put, you know, especially in dedication to Ken, because, you know, I know he likes this sort of stuff. So, some questions we want to ask. Number one, why should a Christian technologist think Christianly about technology? And this really has to do with responsibility. Number two, how should a Christian technologist think Christianly about technology? And I want to talk about a framework in which to think about this, and that is a model called control. And, you know, at this stage, you might ask, is this not an easy or even trivial task? And the answer is, it's far from it. So here's an outline of the things I want to talk about. Start out with the cultural mandate of dominion that Jack talked about a little bit, and then talk about a model of dominion, which is control. What does that mean? I'll flesh that out. And then talk about some challenges in trying to approach technology as a Christian. Well, The cultural mandate, what is that? Really probably the main portion of scripture that describes this mandate is come from Genesis chapter 1, roughly verses 26 through 28. And I want to read from a description of the cultural mandate that comes from Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth, from 2004. And she says this: in Genesis, God gives what we might call the first job description: be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. The first phrase, be fruitful and multiply, means to develop the social world, build families, churches, schools, cities, governments, laws. The second phrase, subdue the earth, means to harness the natural world, plant crops, build bridges, design computers, compose music. This passage is sometimes called the cultural mandate because it tells us that our original purpose was to create cultures, build civilizations, nothing less. Now, I like this particular description because she says that to subdue the earth means to harness the natural world, plant crops, build bridges, design computers, compose music. Somehow, technology has something to do with the cultural mandate. Now, what exactly does it mean to have dominion, to rule over the earth, to subdue it? Well, I will submit that dominion can be thought of in terms of control. Now, this is not an idea that I think will be foreign to the ASA community. There's a paper, in fact, from an ASA, someone who I think is familiar to the ASA community, Keith Miller, where he talks about dominion as technological control. In fact, that's the title of one of his sections in this paper, Natural Hazards, Challenges to the Creation Mandate of Dominion. What exactly does this mean? What does control mean? And I want to propose a somewhat abstract model of control and see how this applies to the issue of making decisions with respect to dominion, the cultural mandate, and technology. Now, I claim that there are four major ingredients to the notion of control that we want to look at with respect to technology. And these are agency, causality, contingency, and morality. What do I mean by this? Well, roughly speaking, it's this. Agency has to do with human capacity to act and make things happen in the world. Causality is the idea that the actions that we take actually cause other things to happen. Contingency is the idea that things that happen don't happen necessarily regardless of what we do, and that the things we do, depending on what they are, lead to different things that can happen. So that there's sort of an option of things that can happen, a plurality of things that can happen. And finally, morality. How do we decide what things we do as human agents that can cause things to happen in a contingent world? We decide this based on moral values. So, agency. First of all, agency. This is a definition from Wikipedia. Human agency is the capacity for human beings to make choices and to impose those choices on the world. So that's pretty much, I think, what we all accept when we think about what, questions of responsibility. What can we do? What should we do? We're taking for granted that somehow we have human agency. Causality. This is a quote from a book by James Woodward, Making Things Happen, A Theory of Causal Explanation. It's a fairly recent book. He says, it is useful to think of explanatory and causal relationships as relationships that are potentially exploitable for purposes of manipulation and control. So somehow central to the idea of control and manipulation is causality, that the things we do somehow have causal relationships to the things that happen as a consequence. Contingency. What exactly is this? Well, As I said, it has something to do with options, that there are a multiplicity of things that can happen depending on what we do. Now, an option, technically speaking, in some sense, is a possible future given the current control action. So given a particular action that you do now, a possible future that results from that, I mean, there are many, depending on what other things you do in the future, you can think of that as an option. And so somehow, there is a set of options that exists with every action that we take. And you can think of the notion of controllability or degree of control in terms of the richness of this set of options. How many possible paths are there in the future? Now, so why, what am I doing with, you know, this sort of abstract model of control? Well, it's really to provide you a framework, a way in which we can understand how we make decisions about technology. And basically this this is it. Oh wait, no, well, this morality too, of course. Morality has to do with decision making. Now, I want to introduce a word here called counterfactual analysis. Decision making in this framework has something to do with deciding among your sort of control choices, among possibilities in the future, options, right? And this involves deciding, hey, what if I do this, what would happen? What if I do this, what would happen? What if I do this, what would happen? This sort of analysis is called counterfactual analysis, perhaps a misnomer. Really, maybe it should be called sort of just contingency analysis or conditional analysis or something like that. But it's really, it boils down to asking what if questions. And Jack talked a lot about that in his talk as well. So we're talking about evaluation of options here. And the evaluation is based on moral judgment. And this is where Christianity and our doctrinal truths that imply moral values come into play in decision making. So, technology and control. How, as a summary, I guess, of how that abstract model provides us a way to think about making decisions in technology, perhaps we can say, number one, that in some significant sense, technology increases control. I think that's clear. So technology helps us to fulfill the cultural mandate of dominion. So in really, given that sort of model that I propose, what we have to do is to make good technological decisions, right? And what does that involve? It involves doing counterfactual analysis with our options, basically. Now, this, of course, turns out to be tremendously challenging. And so, really, I want to spend the rest of my time talking about these challenges. And I, you know, being your typical academic, I'm really going to be raising more questions than providing answers or solutions. That's for you to do during the luncheon discussions at, you know, 12:15. So, what sort of challenges can we think about when it comes to this sort of decision making? Well, here are some of them, and these are the ones I want to talk about. Number one, futurology. What's that? It's really just the consideration of the future. Number two, managing options. Number three, moral judgment. And number four, thinking about the rate of change of technology versus or in comparison to the rate of change of humans. Let me talk a bit about futurology. Well, in sort of keeping with Jack's quiz, you know, that he had in the beginning, I have a quiz of my own. What single word best describes technology, if indeed there is one? Well, I think it's future, right? Perhaps. No more than a few months ago, in a room in this very building, we had a conference called Future Visions, sponsored by ISTEC, And in this conference, which is held once every couple of years, we talk about what sort of things are in place for the future of our students at CSU, for society, for culture. And this poster right here depicts a scene from a virtual world piece of software called Second Life. I don't know if any of you have sort of dabbled with or played around with Second Life. Well, basically the way it works is that you download this piece of software to your computer, you register in Second Life, and you create, your sort of the reflection of your character in Second Life called an avatar, one of these. So these are all avatars of people, of real people who have registered. And your avatar can be sort of the person you always dreamed of being, a rock star looking type or whatever, or it could be someone that looks just like you. Terry, do you have an avatar of Second Life? No? But you've been in Second Life, right? Yeah, I mean, in Second Life, people can have meetings. They can own things. You can actually buy things in Second Life. You can buy property. You can buy gadgets. You can buy clothes. You can fly in Second Life. You can sort of, it's almost like you. What do they call it when you fly from one place to another in Second Life?
Teleport.
Yeah, teleport. Exactly. You can teleport from one place in Second Life to another very quickly. Well, with this sort of technology, there are a lot of things you can think about, but there are some things that are, in some sense, if you want to integrate faith with technology, there are some obvious things you can think about, right? And if you do a quick search on the internet, you'll see that people talk about this thing called the Second Life Gospel, the potential for evangelism and church planting in Second Life. You can go buy a piece of land, buy materials and build a church in Second Life and have Sunday service in Second Life if you want, or do evangelism, meet people, go knock from on doors in Second Life, teleport, do whatever you want. Anyway, there's a quote from a fellow named Matt Rich I want to read, which is posted on this particular website right here. Matt Rich actually apparently is a frequent online evangelist. He says this. He says, "The other day I went into Second Life to have a look around, and once I had mastered the controls," "I searched for a coffee shop and picked one randomly to teleport to. I wanted to find somewhere to sit and relax, hoping to have a chat with someone who was enjoying an online cup of coffee. I arrived at a building with tables and chairs outside and comfy settees inside. And so I went in and sat down with a few others. I chatted with someone there, and it wasn't long before our discussion had turned to spiritual things, and we talked about whether there could be a God and who Jesus really was. We talked for about 2 hours and covered a lot of things, including sin, forgiveness, and Jesus' death on the cross." So this is sort of an obvious application of technology in the Christian world. But the waters of the future are deep and murky. And I want to illustrate this just with a couple of examples about people thinking about the future. Now, I myself subscribe to several publications that relate to the future, but probably one that I enjoy reading a lot is PC World, which does talk about Macs from time to time as well. But the March 2008 issue of PC World, which is sitting somewhere in my house right now, isn't that funny? It's not even March yet, and I already have the March 2008 issue. See, future. I'm thinking about the future. But they have an article in there called "The Next 25 Years," and he says this about PCs. He says, "PCs may disappear from your desk by 2033. But with digital technology showing up everywhere else, including inside your body, computing will only get more personal." So, maybe in the future I wouldn't have to wake up and turn on my computer. It'd just be part of me, right? I could just wish my wife good morning immediately. But in thinking about this, I wanted to look back at what PC World said about PCs of today, What did they say at that time? So I looked back, and here's a 1987 issue of PC World that says this. When you walk into an office in 1998, the PC will sense your presence, switch itself on, and promptly deliver your overnight email sorted in order of importance. Well,
that's what my Mac does.
Yeah, I want to see that. Are you sure it's not just automatically rebooting or something? Look, this was 19. This is 10 years ago. My PC doesn't do anything like this right now. I still have to wake up and turn it on, you know. I'll give you another example. This example is slightly different because it illustrates something quite predictable, and it has to do with the progress of storage technology, storing data. There was an article about a year ago in the Scientific American called A Digital Life, which says the following. It says, new systems may allow people to record everything they see and hear, and even things they cannot, and to store all these data in a personal digital archive. Now, that's interesting, that's about what they're saying. Now, it turns out that growth in storage technology has been quite predictable, at least in our recent past. And this sort of growth that they're talking about was predicted even in the 90s, you know, 10 years ago or more. And I want to illustrate that by a particular paper that comes from the 90s that you can read on the web by a fellow, let's see. Actually, I want to read a quote first from this article. I want to read a quote from this article by Gordon Bell and Jim Gemmell. They say that the growth of digital storage capacity has been staggering. Today, a $600 hard drive can hold a terabyte or 1 trillion bytes of data, which is enough to store everything you read, including emails, web pages, papers and books, all the music you purchase, 8 hours of speech, and 10 pictures a day for the next 60 years. If current trends continue, within a decade, you will be able to carry the same amount of information in your cell phone's flash memory while connecting wirelessly to a $100 4 terabyte drive on your PC. In 20 years, $600 will buy 250 terabytes of storage, enough to hold tens of thousands of hours of video and tens of millions of photographs. Now, the thing that's staggering about this is that I can remember probably no more than 10, 15 years ago, my Mac, and I had a Mac at the time, having 80 megabytes of hard drive. I have 80 gig in here at this little laptop, right? So we're talking about something like a 1,000-fold increase in capacity in about 10 years. Now, this is a huge amount of increase in a short amount of time. 80 megs of memory is what I have in my handheld PDA today. Now, if what they're saying is true, then a quick calculation suggests the following. That, and I did this calculation based on this type of growth estimates, that in 20 years, you know, which is not all that long from now, for less than $100, which is about the price we pay, you know, for things like iPods and things like that, perhaps more for an iPod, but for some other personal music player, we can buy storage that will hold the entire Library of Congress books at that time. Now, this means essentially that we can buy for less than $100, maybe for $50 or something like that, a piece of thing, you know, that's probably the size of your palm, that holds every single published work ever. It'll have Ken's book in it, it'll have Jack's book, my book, everything you've ever written will be in it, etc., right? So, well, you know, That's staggering if you think about it. Why would anyone actually buy a book at that point, right? The only question is how you would control access to the thing in this piece of hard drive or whatever it is that you can buy, right? You know, you might as well just, you know, there wouldn't be anything called a bookstore anymore, right? Because that store would only sell one thing, which is this piece of thing that you can buy that holds all books, right? And then you might have to pay some money to actually read Jack's content, which at that time probably be something like $5,000. Right? Yeah. So I say buy it now. You know? So there's a fellow named Michael Lesk who wrote this back in the 90s. He says that there'll be enough storage space and tape storage in the world to store everything people write, say, perform, or photograph. So this is a paper by Michael Lesk. How much information is there in the world? And you can read this. It's from the 90s. Very predictable. Storage capacity growth has been very predictable. But even so, you could ask questions like this. Will we want this? You know, is this what you want? A little later, we'll read a little bit more about what Michael Lesk says in relation to the rate of change of technology versus human capacity and human characteristics. And I will want to think about this. But even predictable as the growth of storage capacity is, we don't know whether we want it or not. How will we use it? It's unclear. Another challenge is the challenge of handling the options that we have that technology endows upon us. Now, I think it'd be an understatement to say that it's extremely difficult to do counterfactual analysis on technology. I mean, we have all kinds of difficulties when doing that. We have difficulties in predicting the future. We have difficulties in predicting the effects of actions that we have, whether intended, unintended, when that effect takes place, and so forth. And we have difficulties in evaluating the options. There's so many options. I mean, is that good? Is that bad? You know, you can have debate all day long and not come to any conclusions about it. Just want to give a few illustrations of this. First of all, the notion of knowledge and control. Now, this is a well-known phrase penned more than 400 years ago by the great Sir Francis Bacon, and he, you know, which says, scientia potentia est, which roughly speaking translates to knowledge is power. Now, what does he mean by that? He means, I mean, you know, he was a philosopher of science, and really he's thinking about the success story that science has brought about. And roughly speaking means knowledge enhances our ability or potential to do things. That's what power means, right? It's related somehow to controllability, capacity to have control. So really, more knowledge entails, implies more control, right? Well, unfortunately, as human beings, we have limitations, and even if there is more control, we have problems dealing with it. There's the notion of knowledge overload. And here's a quote from a February 2008 issue of Wired magazine, which is one of my favorite magazines, commenting on technology and society. And Wired magazine says this, before science, we humans had dominion over Earth, the center of the universe. Now we're just a bunch of hairless apes on a wet rock orbiting a minor star in the marginal galaxy. I mean, what's he saying, right? Is he saying we have less control now? You know, previously we had dominion and now we no longer have dominion? No, really, what he's saying is that we feel like we have less dominion now, right? It's not that we have less dominion, but we feel like we have less. Why? Because we know more now, which is a very strange thing if you think about it. It's really a psychological problem of sorts, right? It's not a problem about control. It's a problem about our psyche. Similarly, there's the notion of options overload, right? I mean, have you ever bought a device that just can do so many things that you're sick of using it? You don't even want to touch it, right? It scares you, right? That it's like, now, the fact is, you can always pick it up and use it for the very thing you want to use it for, but no, it's like, ooh, I don't, you know, this, I'm suspicious of this thing, right? It's like, it does so many things, I don't even know where to start, right? So the human mind has problems managing too many options. So what that really results in is that increased controllability feels like decreased controllability. Again, it is a problem with the human condition.
Edwin, now you know why a Mac mouse only has one button.
Yes.
It's exactly that.
I've always known that about Mac mice. It's Mac users can only handle one button. Oh, man. Okay. That's the notion of added temptation when you have more controllability. I mean, if you have more options, you know, in some very, at least superficial sense, you also have more temptation, right? Because some of these options are not morally, let's say, good. Let me quote from an author on this website, the Gospel, you know, Second Life Gospel website. And it's a Second Life evangelist who says the following. I joined Second Life with the thought of it being a great mission field. However, being lonely in marriage, I actually met someone that I began to spend a lot of time with. Even us Christians are vulnerable. Instead of sharing the good news of Christ, I actually, surprising to me, found myself in a virtual life of sin. Avatars in Second Life can do anything that humans do, including a huge world of sex. An ugly reality, I guess, of the increased options that we have, even with the superficial things of technology and our integration of faith with it. Moral judgment. Well, moral judgment is something that we have to reckon with whenever we're evaluating our options. And Jack gave, I think, a fabulous procedure for doing that with respect to four areas of morality, let's say, areas in which we can consider our moral judgment. This falls within, I guess, a discipline called technology assessment. Now, technology assessment is a term of art. You can read what the definition of it is, for example, by doing a search on Google. There's an office for technology assessment, right? The OTA. But if you go to Google and look at Wikipedia for the definition of technology assessment, prominent in that definition is this piece of commentary about technologists as ethicists. And it says this: technology assessment recognizes the fact that scientists normally are not trained ethicists themselves and accordingly ought to be very careful when passing ethical judgment on their own or their colleagues, new findings, projects, or work in progress. So, I mean, the first thing they tell you about technology assessment is that you're bad at it. All of you. Well, that's nice. Finally, I want to think about an issue with respect to morality that is related to intrinsic value. And Jack pointed this out as well early on in his talk. And that is this. I want to ask this question. Is technology intrinsically good or bad? Now, I'm really now talking about intrinsic goodness, okay? Goodness in and of itself. I'm not talking about the value of the causes that technology can have. So if you want to answer this question, counterfactual analysis is not going to help you. There's no point thinking about what this can result in. Now, of course, there can be goodness or badness in the results of it too, but I'm asking a different question. I want to know if technology is intrinsically good or intrinsically bad, or whether there exists any technology that's intrinsically good or any examples of technology that are intrinsically bad. Whatever your answer is, this sort of intrinsic value has to be factored into our moral judgment. Now, I'll have to say that technologists are bad at thinking about intrinsic goodness or badness. And you know this just by talking to technologists. Technologists want to measure everything, right? If it's not measurable, there's no value. You know, the value can only be discussed and talked about in the context of something measurable about it. So if you can't measure that, you know, it's meaningless to talk about it. Yes?
How would you rate economists?
Congress?
Economists.
Oh, economists. You know, I would say that economists have arrived at the same sort of thing as well. You know, with the advent of utility theory and so forth, it's all a matter of utility, right? Or some kind of utility function. The measurement of value has to do with its corresponding value, let's say, in the world of utility and utility functions, right? But intrinsic goodness is something totally different. It has to do with in and of itself. Now, I went to a conference last year in the fall, sponsored by the C.S. Lewis Foundation, and and some of you were in that conference in this audience as well. It was held in Boulder at the University of Colorado, and the title of it was I think something like the crisis in the university or something like that. And a big aspect of that crisis is this division, this dichotomizing within the university between two schools of thought, having to do with, in one sense, value, and in the other, what's the other one? It's the fact-value dichotomy, right? It's like, look, one side of the university discusses and deals with facts. The other side deals with values. Not really anything intrinsically true about it. You know, so that's the sciences where, you know, we do experiments and yes, we've discovered, you know, this new particle. And then there's the other side where, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better analogy, you know, people talking about poetry and so forth. And so, you know, people in engineering schools like myself, we quote unquote tolerate our students and having to take things like poetry or Greek, you know, the Greek classics or whatever in their freshman year for the sake of breadth, but really it's useless stuff, right? You know, it has no practical use. You can't measure any goodness from that. But you see, here therein lies the problem, right? We're talking about intrinsic goodness now. It has nothing to do with whether or not you can measure your engineering, let's say, productivity, you know, after reading Plato's Republic. Is there intrinsic goodness in that? Now, most technologists will not recognize intrinsic goodness in things like that. And for that reason, the whole I would hazard to say that the rest of the university is following suit. Money, for example, is the measurement, the currency that let's say by which all faculty are judged nowadays. Right? How much money can you bring in? In research grants and contracts and so forth. Even the university has been called, even in its most academic sense, a marketplace of ideas. Marketplace, as if money rules the place. And how many university presidents are now called CEOs, as if they were running companies? And so because of that, people in this, you know, there's the fact value dichotomy in the university, and people on the fact side of things, you know, like it or not, they get paid more. They get more resources. They get more recognition in some significant way.
Unless you're the coach.
Oh, yeah, well, that has to do with money, too, right? Unless you're the coach, yes. Okay, I won't say anything. So I attended a breakout session in this conference, and this breakout session was for people in the sciences and engineering and mathematics and so forth, you know, people who are more likely to be technologists. And, you know, in this breakout session, you know, they were talking, so what is the big deal about all this fact, you know, what crisis are we talking about? And some people tried to articulate, say, oh, no, that's what the, you know, the plenary speaker said, that the crisis means this and means that, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's terrible. And, you know, it was clear that none of them, like, really could relate to it. And so in the end, I sort of pointed out, I said, look, I bet all of you would rather have it this way, wouldn't you? And they laughed because they're the people who earn more money. than the other side of the university. They in fact are measured. They come up looking better with respect to the kind of metrics that the university has set upon us. So this whole notion of intrinsic value is something that we have great difficulty in grappling with if you're a technologist. The Bible talks about creation being good. In Genesis 1:31, we read of God's declaration of the goodness of creation. Now, is he talking about the intrinsic goodness? I think that there's a strong theological basis for that kind of conclusion of intrinsic goodness of creation, and by implication, the intrinsic goodness of technology. And if so, then we have a moral responsibility to engage in it, just based on intrinsic goodness. Now, human limitations is something that we have to think about, and it's difficult to grapple with. The lack of change in human characteristics over time relative to technology is a two-edged sword. I mean, you know, we've seen that technology can change by huge amounts in even a period of 5, 10, 20 years, well within the lifetime or even remaining lifetime of many humans, including those in this audience. Now, on the one hand, this eases our prediction of human characteristics in the future. Roughly speaking, we're going to be the same 20 years from now as we are now. And, you know, we can take that into account. It eases our prediction of the things to come, right? We can make decisions now. We don't have to count on us, for example, you know, having more day, you know, more hours in the day then, or, you know, being able to sleep much less than we sleep now, and so forth, or being able to fly or something, except in maybe Second Life. Now, on the other hand, it's not going to get any easier to manage technology 20 years from now than it is now, because our limitations are going to be roughly the same. I want to read a paragraph from the paper by Michael Lesk that I showed you earlier, which was written, like I said, in the 90s. And this is what he says about the growth in storage technology. He says, could we simply make a wearable device that would record everything? Yes, if either A, we had decent speech recognition and OCR, optical character recognition, or B, books move to electronic form and TV sets provide access to the closed caption ASCII form of the scripts. Perhaps both of these choices are likely in the near future. School children no longer need to do arithmetic without calculators. Perhaps they will soon no longer need to memorize anything either. If you think this is horrible, remember that Plato in the Phaedrus suggested that writing would create forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, and would create the show of wisdom without the reality. Writing he's talking about here, okay? So I say, you know, shame on Ken, shame on Jack, and me, and all of you who have done any writing. If writing something isn't cheating, why is recording it? Says Michael Lesk. It is now common for speakers to use transparencies. Transparency, hey, we're using PowerPoint, you know, on a computer. For a conference to hand out printed proceedings and materials, and for people to sit at talks with cassette recorders. This was written in the 90s, okay? This thing here has flash drive memory in it, right? Would it be that terrible if each attendee had a laptop doing speech recognition, and the laptop kept the transcript and provided a small vibration to wake up the attendee when a promising topic was mentioned? Could technology itself be a solution to managing technology? Can technology be harnessed to help predict the future? Do counterfactual analysis? Something that we're not good at, because You know, computers presumably don't have a psyche where you present it with more than about one button on a mouse, you know, it gets all confused. Evaluate options. Can technology be used to evaluate? What would we have to do to make this happen, if indeed it's possible? How? You know, what are we going to do? Like, in evaluating these options, do we program in values that reflect our morality? Perhaps. I mean, for example, Jack's matrix can be programmed into an Excel spreadsheet, right, even today. And you could generate that chart relatively easily and painlessly for many decision-making projects that you have. You know, whether it be, you know, to have this sort of mass transportation system, or to build a new zoo in town, or to cut down some trees so that you could have, you know, a baseball park. In fact, in thinking about harnessing technology as a solution to managing technology as Christians, we want to ask whether we can even avoid this at all. Can this be avoided? And let me quote again from Michael Lesk in his paper from the 90s. He says, storage media will outrun our ability to create things to put on them. And so, after the year 2000, the average disk drive or communications link will contain machine-to-machine communication, not human-to-human communication. When we reach a world in which the average piece of information is never looked at by a human, we will need to know how to evaluate everything automatically to decide what should get the precious resource of human attention. This was written in the 90s, and he says by the year 2000. And I thought, this is another one of these futurology issues. But then I started to think about the things we do at research and the objects of our research. And I think he's right. Most of the data that goes around on the internet is not your email or a picture that you're sending or a PowerPoint file or something like that, right? It's stuff that your computer is talking to about with some other computer. You know, if you don't believe me, just open your laptop, and especially if you have Windows Vista. See, I'm on your side.
Getting close.
It's like before you even put a single file on it, the thing takes, you know, a couple of hundred gigs. I don't know what. It's like, what is this stuff, right? And then you just open a random file in it, and you're like, what is this? What is in this? What is this thing? Why is there this data in there? Who's needing it, and who's examining it? And are they doing a good job doing, you know, examining this? Now, so the average piece of information is never looked at by a human. And according to Michael Lesk, we need to know how to evaluate everything automatically to decide what should get the precious resource of human attention. Isn't that amazing? Human attention is going to start being the most precious resource in the technological age. That's going to be what's scarce. Now, what kind of economics deals with the scarcity of human attention? You know, it's going to be a whole new field, probably, right? Now, you know, we talked about the growth of storage, right, capacity, and that in about 20 years you can buy something that holds virtually every piece of written material ever. It includes Plato's Republic in it too, okay? And that storage will start to grow faster than people can start to produce writing. Well, okay, let's put more in it then. Don't just put writing, put all music ever recorded. Wait 2 years and all music ever recorded will be added to that device. Okay, all movies ever produced, including the oldies and every blockbuster hit. Wait another couple of years, it'll be in that device, right? And movie making cannot catch up with the growth of this thing. Eventually, you'll have nothing to put in there. But here's the thing, right? Human characteristics are limited. What's the point of having 3,800,000 movies in a piece of thing you can carry with you? Even if you were watching it all day long, you never finish watching all the movies, right? you know, because our capacity to watch movies, it's just not that great, really. You know, at most you're going to watch one a day, right? And if that, you know, you would want to question the morality of doing things like that. Instead of spending time, let's say, with your kids. You might say, well, I spend time with my kids. I see them on Second Life every day. You know, I have to confess that during the day I try to communicate with my wife by email. I'm sending her email about stuff, you know. It's like, what will we do tonight again? You do it too, right?
I am. I am is better.
Okay, you're right. I'm not quite there yet, yes.
And then the camera.
I have a vow of silence, and I think that that's not... Christians should influence such automatic decision-making. This is clear. The only question is, how? What can we do? How do we influence it? That's the end of my talk. So, it turns out that thinking Christianly about technology is enormously difficult. And anyone who's a Christian technologist who says that, what's the big deal? You know, what's there to think about? Is hugely misguided. But we must. Good timing. I'll take some questions.
It's done. I'm a pastor, and thinking Christianly about technology, you say, is enormously difficult, and it is. Because we are, in a sense, competing with that technology for the attention of the people. And it is extremely difficult. They are used to the sound bites, the visual bites that are out there, and we want to give them a 30 or 40 minute sermon.
Right. Ah, yes.
So it's a two-edged sword. How do we accomplish?
Yes.
You raised a lot of good questions, and that's another one.
Oh yes, especially if you're a pastor of a church. You know, what about talks like this, right? You know, we spend an hour just having me talk to you. I mean, there'll come a time when you'll think, you know, why do I need to do this, right? Are we still going to value it? Now, of course, many people think that we will. We will continue to want to preserve the sort of relationships and modes of communication that we have today. But surely you have to accept the idea that some things will change, right? I mean, there was a time in the past that we don't expect to have meetings, let's say, in virtual worlds. In Future Visions, that talk in which one of the plenary talks in Future Visions, that the conference I talked about, had one of the participants, actually not just one, several of the participants, actually participate in the plenary talk in Second Life. Now, of course, they did this to illustrate, you know, in some sense, the coolness of Second Life. But the fact is, it happened that way. But what they are predicting is that Second Life has applications in things like distance education, having conferences. You know, every one of you in this room is here because you could get here. Right? Maybe some of you live in Boulder or somewhere far away, but still, you could drive here in an hour, right? Or a little more than that. But what if you lived in California? You'd have to fly here.
We teleport.
Exactly, right? I mean, it's like...
So webcast. Tomorrow.
Is there a webcast tomorrow? Tomorrow? Oh, I see. You're going to be putting this on. What are the possibilities for example, having a meeting like that? It'd be meaningless to talk about the ASA Rocky Mountain section anymore, right? Why not just have the whole ASA, you know, all scientific affiliation societies around the world have a common meeting in Second Life, for example? You don't have to go anywhere, just sit at home. You know, in fact, you don't have to get out of your pajamas or bedclothes, whatever, you know. It's like you wake up, you walk straight to your computer, turn it on, you're on. You're part of this conference.
Question I would ask on this teleconferencing and all that, is that I find a lot of meetings I go to, the most valuable conversations are those over beers afterwards.
Yes.
And in teleconferencing, you're taking other people's time, you have to be logged in, you have to manage all of these things.
Yes.
The serendipity isn't as easy to happen.
Sure. Correct. Now, that's the case today. Now, what if we arrived at a situation, and I don't know how long this will take, where interaction, virtual interaction between people will be indistinguishable from actual interaction? For example, there'd be a hologram, let's say, sitting right beside you now, someone who couldn't physically come here but is participating. You can't tell whether this guy's a hologram or not. You know, it's like he touched me, goes, ouch, what are you booking me for? You know, et cetera, right?
Twitter. I don't know if you know Twitter's example of sort of a online water break place where you go and just chat with whoever's there and share thoughts, serendipity.
Okay, yeah. So we have chat and so forth, right? And really, it has to do somewhat with human psychology as well. I mean, for example, if you were brought up, like my kids, for example, in a situation where these things are not so foreign, not so difficult to grasp and accept, they are more likely to have relationships with people in virtual worlds like that than perhaps you or I would be, because we don't find it very appealing to be talking to someone on a screen. Whereas maybe when my daughter grows up, she wouldn't mind, and then she wouldn't mind leaving home and living thousands of miles away from me, and I'd be like, why don't you come home and see her for Thanksgiving? And she'd be like, what do you mean? I'm seeing you right now, you know, and stuff like that, right? You know, can I deal with that when the time comes, you know?
Yes, thank you very much. And all of the options that are there for us and the agencies, which you also talked about, are currently encoded through language and or images. So the ways that those are constructed, the various choices of the words that would be used to present one option, option A versus option B versus option C, really is dependent on the very language choices that we make and the imagistic logic that would be put together.
Yes.
So how do we prioritize that? How do we look at those kinds of choices that present to us our maps of what that is going to be about, and with so much data to sort through?
Oh, that's an excellent. Are you in education? I'm trying to remember.
I am, yes. I'm at the University of Northern Colorado. I deal with rhetorical analysis, where we have various models by which we analyze the components of language and images.
Thank you. I thought you might be someone who works in education. I mean, the fact is this, right? Throughout history, we've always had media elements and devices that help us to do counterfactual analysis. I mean, for example, the classic cautionary tale is something like that, right? You tell a story that from which you somehow conclude at the end of it that, oh, that path is bad, right? Mm-hmm. Now, today, of course, cautionary tales are common even in movies, right? You know, you watch a movie like, I don't know, The Godfather or something like that, and you say, oh, you know, I'm so glad I don't live in that world, and, oh, you know, it's good that I watched that movie, right? Well, in the future, maybe there'll be technology will help us to do counterfactual analysis in a way where a cautionary tale perhaps is lived out, right? You know, it's like in a flash of, a matter of seconds, maybe you have lived out a cautionary tale of some sort and decide that, let me not go there because, you know, this is going to happen or that's going to happen or the world's going to be bad or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, these sorts of things, right? And then people in education like yourself at that time would have to grapple with, well, what does it mean to teach things anymore, right? That's a great point, Rich.
One of the other issues that this technology raises, Terry and I talked about it after one of our board meetings, is the nature of authority in all these interactions. And is that the so-called democratization of knowledge. You quoted Wikipedia. Who wrote that? What was his expertise? And why did you quote him, not knowing who in the world wrote that article? In terms of, is that really what technology assessment is about? So for those of us that were before all this happened, is find it disturbing. But I was going to say, people with my daughter's generation, that's fine. And it's Don's question about the sermon is like, what kind of authority does a pastor have versus we're gonna share our ignorance amongst other like questions of spirituality. And so it raises some issues with respect to what happens with respect to authority and the interior dimension. What about a professor? Do you really need a professor? Kind of thing in terms of the university system.
Yeah, great point. I mean, authority is going to be problematic. As Christians, the claim of the authority of Scripture is going to be ever so more important in centering our thoughts, isn't it, Jack? And then Kim.
I first got to know you 6 weeks ago, it was through telephone and email, sometimes both at the same time. And I want to tell the group that you're just as delightful in the flesh as you were in virtual reality. But this issue that you've raised at the end, an ominous black cloud or mountain to climb, rather than saying, here, do it, and I'll tell you how. But I'm wrestling with that, and I've tried to offer the solution of task groups or expert groups. Don said the same thing. Well, hey, how can I do this to my congregation? It's hard enough just to teach them Scripture. I can't teach them technology. And I'm saying, well, yeah, but technology is competing for our faith and our trust as much as the Christian faith, as much as postmodernism, as much as the new atheism of Richard Dawkins and so on. It's another threat to the faith that's out there and very real and very dominant. Do you agree with me that task forces can take on these things one technology at a time and break it down into manageable pieces and maybe make progress that way?
I'm optimistic with respect to that sort of pursuit, absolutely. I guess part of the this sort of talk, this type of attitude that I'm taking, is really it's a call to arms or something. I mean, I'm ringing an alarm, let's say, because so many of my technology colleagues don't think that there's much to think about Christianly in technology, and I'm saying that that's so far from being right that. It's not even close, right? That so much we have to do. I mean, and so yeah, I think you're exactly right. Why aren't Christian technologists in task forces like you're talking about? I was a part of the formation of an institute on campus called the Public Policy Institute. There was one engineer on that committee. One engineer. The rest of the people were in, you know, the liberal arts and the humanities. But surely a big part of public policy relates to technology. How come we're not participating in it as technologists, you know, let alone Christian technologists? We're not trained as ethicists. Well, why aren't we getting training as ethicists? There you go, you know, and many professional societies in engineering are recognizing that. That's why they have task forces in ethics and so forth. As well, but yeah, absolutely, I'm with you on that. You know, why Jack is right.
I'd like to suggest that perhaps Plato was right as well. I think he spent a lot of time trying to imagine the future, but we spend less time trying to reconstruct the past in the sense of putting a value on what we have lost as well as what we gained. I'm not suggesting that I would want to go back to
mental passivity. Yeah, that's a good thought. Maybe you're right. Maybe Plato was right. I suppose the reason that the author mentions Plato and his views on writing is, I guess, he's trying to be funny and also to sort of show that, you know, how wrong people could have been. But maybe you're right. Maybe he wasn't wrong at all. You know, what did I say was mixed? I'm sorry. Okay, well.
I do pediatrics.
Okay.
You know, it is tricky to me when I have a family that doesn't know what's going on with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
They email 3 times a day. They text each other. They email each other from their bedrooms. Literally, this is not isolated incidents. And I say to a parent with a troubled kid, can you guys spend, ideally I would start with a half hour, but I'm down to now 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guys spend 10 minutes a day together? It's like I'm saying, can you pour a hot tar up your nose? I mean, I'm a people though. And I don't deal with a unique set of people. I mean, I work at a clinic for the working poor, so they usually have lost their health insurance or losing their house, they've lost a job, or there's some catastrophic thing going on with the family. But to think that in the year 2008, we're saying, like, it's great the kids can contact parents with cell phones, with, you know, whatever. Everybody's in contact with each other, but I have no clue that my daughter has had an abortion, my son has an STD, my other kid's snorting crack, a coke, no clue at all. I can't even share this stuff with the parents because under state law of Colorado, those kids' adolescents are under a different law.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as adults, we're very secure. I'm in contact. I've got that information. I'm in contact. And it's like, oh my word. I mean, kids sit in the car, the front seat, with earphones on.
Mm.
And naive adults think, my kid's with me, I really know what's going on.
Yeah.
They are so separated by these really scary boxes that everybody's in.
Right. It's, yeah, I mean, you know, there are stories, I guess, of maybe on the flip side of things, of people having relationships only because of technology, and not because of it, they would have not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, too.
Sure.
Exactly, I mean, how do we grapple with that? Stephen Hawking would not be the kind of treasure that he is,
mm-hmm,
to science and to, you know, sort of public commentary, if not for the fact that he can communicate with us through technology.
Let's actually cut it off right now.
Okay.
Let's thank Edwin.